Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back here on the program once again Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service for a program that we do every month here to talk about home maintenance. Now, if something needs to be fixed, you don't know exactly how to go about it, we can do that. Maybe you're thinking of making some changes, doing some remodeling. We can take on just about any part of the single-family home. So it could be about roofing or windows or siding or heating and cooling or basements or attics or, you know, whatever. You can give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And we do also have a toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. Always a pleasure to come out and see you.
We have somebody ready to go already, and we will talk with them. The first caller is in Mattoon, line four. Hello.
Good morning, mm-hmm. Scott. I have a stain in my water. I'm in the city. I have city water, and it has stained the refrigerator, the disposer, the ice disposer, and the water. And also, if the water sits on my drain board for and evaporates, there's a yellow stain. I've had my plumber, and he's looked under the house, and he said I have all copper tubing, and he sees no reason why I should have that problem. He went to the water department, and according to him, they said, well, nobody else has complained about it. And I wonder what you might think about it.
Well, it sounds like a water purity problem, not necessarily a pipe problem, because generally even a steel pipe with a little bit of rust, as long as you run water on a regular basis, you're not going to get a buildup of that rust from the pipe. About the only place you're going to get it is actually in the water coming from the city. There are several different water softening or even water filtration type systems that you could use that would purify the water a little bit, particularly drinking water for like the refrigerator and ice cubes and such.
Well, I did have a filter installed under the house because the city didn't seem to be interested in my problem. I am right by a fire hydrant at my corner. I don't know if that has a bearing on it.
No, because the fire hydrant, while it's connected to the water system, is closed off and really should not have any flow or any bearing on it. It almost has to be a source problem. About the only thing I could think of is you might want to find somebody that can do some water sampling independently of the city to find out if there's a high iron content or something that would be causing a rusting or something that would be causing your yellowing or discoloring.
Where would that be coming from? It wouldn't be under my house then.
No, I doubt very much that it has anything to do with your property.
Uh-huh.
On a single family home, you run the water enough that you keep the lines pretty well flushed out for the most part. Every once in a while on a vacant house, I'll find some rust at a faucet where somebody used a piece of steel for a tub faucet or something like that. But even then, running it for just a few minutes and the water will clear right up.
Mm-hmm.
I would consider getting some type of independent. Usually most water tests are not that terribly expensive. You're probably looking at $60 or $70 to get somebody to check for chlorine, check for any bacterias, irons, and things like that.
Who would I contact for that?
Well, you could start with the Illinois State Water Survey and see who they recommend and see if they do some testing.
And where are they located?
Here in Champaign, I do believe.
On the campus
of
the
campus
university.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'd like to ask you, is copper tubing for water the best thing to use? Or say I was building a new house, what would the installation be?
Most looked piping in this area is still done with copper, yes, and they use a lead-free solder. One of the new products coming out is what they call PEX, which is a cross-linked polycarbonate plastic. Basically comes in a roll, and it seems to be coming easier and easier to put in. And, of course, being a plastic, it's a little less expensive than copper. I don't know that it has a proven track record as of this time. They've been using plastic pipes for housing for 20 years, but this new PEX is PEX is just now coming out on the market where it's getting widespread use.
Well, is it CVC, the white plastic?
That would be a CPVC for hot water or just plain PVC for cold water. The hot water is got a little bit different
plastic. Is that a good substitute for copper?
Yes, it works well. Usually with CPVC or PVC pipe, you have a lot of joints, and the problem becomes whether or not the glue holds at the joints, which is one of the reasons why I'm not real impressed with it. The PEX or the polycarbonate line or polyvinyl line is a flexible, so they don't have to put anywhere near as many joints in it. They can bend it around corners and stuff, and instead of having to put 45s and 90s everywhere, so it has fewer joints and fewer leaks.
And it's a different tubing for hot water as opposed to cold.
Well, a standard PVC can be used for a cold water line, but if you're running hot, you should run a CPVC. You can use CPVC for either hot or cold. So if you just wanted to buy one type of pipe, you could. Definitely when you're running a hot water, you have to use the CPVC.
Well, this particular builder I have in mind seems to use the plastic tubing rather than copper. And is it worth an upgrade to use the copper, have the copper installed in a new house?
I don't know that it is at this point in time. Like I say, the material hasn't been around for as long as what copper, and we've been using copper for water lines since 1950. So after 50 or 60 years, we got a pretty good handle on how well it lasts, whereas the plastic stuff is still relatively new, so I can't put any guarantees on it. But, of course, everybody touts it as being the next newest best thing. So
yeah,
I wouldn't be afraid of it, no.
Okay. And there's no harm to my health of having a little, I guess it's iron, would you say, that's causing that yellowness?
Most of the time, yeah, it's just a little bit of iron. And to the best of my knowledge, no, I wouldn't expect any health problems. But like I say, some testing of the water wouldn't be a bad idea.
Of course, I do have a filter now under the house.
And that should help.
Yes. But thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Our guest this morning in this first hour of Focus 580 is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Once a month, we do these shows on a Monday to give you a chance to talk about home maintenance. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to talk with someone in Lafayette, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Do the Do the asphalt shingles on my house take any damage if I try to kill mildew on them with the standard 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 water to bleach and then swash it around a while with a push broom before rinsing?
Well, the push broom can knock some of the granules off. You probably don't need to go that far. I would probably just spray it on the roof to kill off the mildew. You could use a pump type sprayer or even a trigger sprayer if you got enough fingers to last that long.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't think that washing it would be necessary. The push broom and even foot traffic on it will tend to wear the granules, and the mineral granules are what protects the asphalt shingles from UV deterioration, from sunlight. So we really don't want to be brushing or brooming any of the granules off of the roof.
Okay, so just spraying, no brushing or
yeah,
rinsing.
Spraying and rinsing would be fine. I would probably just spray it and let it dry up there.
Without rinsing?
Without rinsing, yes.
Okay. Can I ask you also?
Sure.
Garage window in the garage is regular double sash. It's just about frozen in place. How do I lube and loosen it up?
Garage windows can be a little tricky because with a wood double-hung window like that, the wood expands and contracts with temperature and humidity changes. And, of course, the garage is always going to be more humid than what the house is, so we can get some binding. Most of the time, the binding or the sticking is paint, accumulation of paint over the years getting in and around the tracks.
No, I don't paint it.
You don't paint it?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Well, if it's just a bare wood, I would probably try one of the furniture polishes off the top of my head, like a Lemon Pledge or something like that, that will have a little bit of preservative for the wood, but also provides a little bit of an oil, which could be a little bit of a lubricant for the
wood
window.
I shouldn't think wood would be a factor. It slides on regular aluminum track.
Well, there's an aluminum track, but it's a wood frame. And so a little, you know, when the wood expands, it can get tight. That track can be quite tight. And so just a little bit of lubricant. You don't really want an oil that will soak in like a WD-40 or something with wood. But one of the furniture polishes would give it a little bit of lubricant and a little bit of protection to help keep it keep the water from being able to get into it.
And can I use something special on the track?
Never really tried doing much. You could. Something as simple as soap or even a little bit of wax would probably help.
No silicone?
Probably not, because the silicones and the oils tend to draw too much dust, and the dust and dirt can actually create more of a problem than what you're going to actually solve.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Over to Piatt County for our next caller. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Really quickly, I lived in a small ranch house in town, and all around the house was 3 or 4 feet of gravel, white gravel, with black plastic under it, which always had weeds no matter what. And everybody said that's for the house had gutters, and everybody said, oh, that's for drainage, you have to have that. And so I just worked around it and sprayed and so on. But now I'm in we've redone a large barn structure that's on concrete blocks, and contemplating landscaping, actually the drainage out here is excellent. Do I have to use black plastic and gravel around a structure?
Absolutely not.
Oh, thank you.
that's just a landscaping decorum. You don't have to put anything there. Ideally, if the soil has a proper slope away from the house, uh-huh. even with grass right up next to the foundation, uh-huh. You should still get. We've got enough clay in our soil that we don't get a lot of percolation, a lot of water going down through. It kind of runs across on the surface. The BOCA codes, which are the 1 and 2 family dwelling codes, actually have a code, which I very rarely find enforced, mm-hmm. that states that the soil level at the foundation should be 4 to 6 inches below the siding, and from that point where the soil and the foundation meet to a point 10 feet out in the yard should be another 6 to 8 inches of drop.
Oh.
So if you were to have this 6 or 8 inches of slope from your foundation out to the yard, then no landscaping of any type is required. You can put grass or whatever you wanted to put out there. Now, if you've got a basement or a crawl space on a house and the gutters like to overflow, your drip line is usually about 2 feet from the foundation, from your overhang. And in that particular case, it's not a bad idea to put down the plastic so that the water from that drip line doesn't soak into the soil right there at the foundation. So you put out, say, 30 inches or 36 inches of plastic, and then you put something like a landscape bark or a gravel over the top of it. And that's just to keep the soil next to that foundation. But you're saying on a barn-type structure, which I'm guessing is on a slab,
mm-hmm.
No, there is absolutely no reason why you need to do that.
So you can use mulch instead of gravel?
Well, whatever you want to use to cover the plastic just for cosmetics, yes.
Yes, because, gravel's a pain. Okay, you have eased my mind. Thank you so much.
Now, I will say that on the mulch, you want to make sure you get some properly treated mulch, because if you just use stuff that came out of the wood chipper from the tree you took down last year, you are very likely to attract termites closer to the house.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And you also want to make sure that your mulch is not in contact. You don't want it up against the house.
Yeah.
At least you don't want wood to wood.
Yeah, you need to maintain that 4 to 6 inches from whatever your landscaping may be, whether it's grass, gravel, mulch. I actually saw one the other day that was kind of looked like a lava rock, but it was actually a chewed up tire, so it was rubber. Pieces of rubber tire chopped up to make it look like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to keep whatever it is you're putting there about 4 to 6 inches down from the siding so that we have some airflow at the bottom edges of the siding. As the siding heats up, the air behind the siding will rise. And so if we get some air in behind it from the bottom side, we can actually help dry the siding by natural convection. But as soon as you start blocking it by putting something up against the bottom of the siding, now we start keeping some moisture in behind the siding, and you can get some deterioration. And this holds true for vinyl siding. Now, the vinyl siding is not affected by the moisture, but the wood framing behind the vinyl siding is. So even with the vinyl siding, even with brick siding, whatever it is, you want to try and keep that soil level below the wood framing of the house.
All right. Rossville, next car, line three. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question about humidity in my basement. I have a dehumidifier down there, which runs an awful lot of the time. And I just wondered if I could lower the humidity more economically by venting the basement by putting a duct from one basement window at one end of the basement and another one at the other end of the basement and putting a fan on the, you know, exhaust end and pulling air through the basement. Would that actually help me out a little bit?
If you are in Arizona or Death Valley, yes. Unfortunately.
I'd like to.
Unfortunately, we are in Illinois.
Right.
In Illinois, the problem is, other than like today, most of the time our weather is 85 to 90 during the summer with 85 to 90% humidity.
Right.
And you're trying to keep that basement at about a 50 or 55% humidity level. And so if you start trying to ventilate it with outside air, drawing in 80% moisture does not keep your basement at 55%. So, no, the last thing you want to do is, and my guess is the reason you have moisture in the basement is because you are opening windows and you are ventilating upstairs.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not. Okay,
no.
Well, good.
No, it's an old house.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's got some natural air leakage.
Probably. Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah. One of the most efficient ways of dehumidifying in this area is to run an air conditioner, a central air system, and not necessarily turn it up and down every time you're going to be in or out of the house, but just to let it run and pull the moisture down.
I do that.
Okay.
But still in the basement, I have, you know, this situation, and it's pretty constant through the summer.
Well, I would be looking for ways that the water's coming, actual moisture coming through the foundation and not necessarily humidity. Grading, just as we were talking with the last caller, some grading around the exterior of the house to make sure that the soil, is it a brick or a block foundation?
It's a block foundation.
Block foundation. Any water stains in the corners and things like that?
No.
Okay, good, good.
However, when it rains very heavily from, you know, a certain direction, I do get some moisture in the basement from the rain.
Okay.
But even when that dries out, I have this, you know, situation. But,
have you put a humidistat down there to determine just how humid it is down there?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Something you might want to check, and usually a little humidistat, usually under $20 or around $20 from Radio Shack or one of these places, would be something that you could put in down in the basement, maybe another one even upstairs. Ideally, since water, once it evaporates, becomes a vapor. A vapor moves according to vapor pressure. Your basement may not actually be more humid than the rest of the house. It's just cooler down there, so it feels like it's going to be more humid. It's more of a perception. But
okay.
Because vapor pressure tries to equalize throughout a house, and vapor will move through walls, floors, doors, everything except possibly a vapor barrier, you can end up with high humidity levels throughout the house. A power dehumidifier, such as what you're running in the basement, would be almost as effective upstairs as it would be in the basement. I recommend people put them wherever there's a drain so you don't have to continually empty them.
That's one reason it's in the basement.
Yeah. I've had people put one at either end of a basement. I'm like, no, you don't need to do that, because once that dehumidifier pulls moisture out, it creates a low vapor pressure near the dehumidifier. And so the higher vapor pressure or the higher humidity levels elsewhere in the house work towards that low vapor pressure area. And so basically it moves the moisture to the dehumidifier.
Okay.
So you don't need one at each end of the house. You don't need one on different levels. One dehumidifier or conversely one power humidifier is more than enough to either dehumidify or humidify an entire house.
That makes sense.
I get some of these big houses with three furnaces and the furnace man talked them into three power humidifiers. And any one of them is perfectly capable of getting water to drip out of the attic on a regular basis. So, moisture moves by vapor pressure once it's evaporated. I would probably get a humidistat and put it in a room or two and see just how much difference you're getting between your upstairs and downstairs.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Right, very good.
Appreciate all the help you guys get.
All right. Very good. Thanks. We'll go now to Arthur for another caller. Line one. Hello.
I got some mold on a Masonite siding. What should I wash the house with to get rid of it?
A Masonite siding, as in a concrete board type siding?
No.
A Masonite as in a wood fiber siding.
Wood fiber siding.
Well, there's a couple of different things you can do that are commercially available. The easy, quick way of doing it is a little bit of bleach and water, usually about one part to four parts. So you could put a gallon of bleach in a 5-gallon bucket and use a sprayer or something and spray it on there. And again, I just let it dry, and that would let it die off. Now, once it's dead, then you can wash it. I would not pressure wash at a high pressure any fiberboard siding. Your masonite or fiberboard sidings don't take well to high pressure. They will work well with a light pressure from a hose. If there's a lot of mildew build up after you've put the bleach on it and kind of killed it off, you can then take a softer bristle brush, similar to what we'd use for – I've always recommended the brushes for cleaning motorhomes. They have an extended handle and usually have a hose connection where you can connect a hose to the end of it that allow you to reach up to the upper areas. And it's got a soft enough bristle brush that if it won't scratch the side of your motorhome, it's not going to scratch the paint and scar up the siding on the house either.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Okay. And we have somebody here on a cell phone on line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. How about I was wondering, how do you feel about tankless water heaters? And I was thinking about the next house I build, I'm going to basically put a lot of that tankless water heaters and like the rain barrels and all that, just to conserve a little bit. And then I wanted to add something to that gentleman with the humidity thing too. I had a house that had all that problems, and what I did is just use dehumidifiers in there and run them around. I had a lady that actually, I'm a contractor myself, and a lot of bathrooms seem to have the same problem. I just used to tell them to use a dehumidifier. It cured the problem. People just don't like it running, but once the humidity goes out of the room, it shuts itself off. I thought it was pretty neat. So.
Yeah, that definitely, if you're not running your central air on a regular basis, or even in, I know I did some experimentation with my house. I was comfortable in the house at 81 if I had a dehumidifier running, and if I turned the dehumidifier off, I had to turn the house down to 78 to keep it comfortable, just to control the moisture level. And a lot of it depends on how old the house is or how new the house is. A newer house doesn't draw as much outside air, so you don't have as much humidity. As far as your question on the tankless systems, on a new construction, a tankless is something to be considered. I would have to say that on an existing building, the modifications you have to make to the plumbing systems and usually the connections that you end up with on the tankless, you'll probably end up not recovering your costs in a short-term period, in less than 10 years. But in a new construction, they seem to be working quite well. You do have to worry about where you're at. Here in Illinois, it's not a big deal. I know in Colorado, they don't work worth a hoot because water coming out of the ground is 33 degrees and the tankless systems can't get it hot enough to actually be comfortable. They only have a set temperature that they will actually warm it up from. Here it comes out of the ground at about 55 degrees, so it's a little bit easier for it to bring it up to temperature. I've seen a lot of instances where a tankless at one end of the house and then a smaller tankless for like a master bathroom that's at the far end would work. So you may want to, if you've got a long run from one area to another, you may want to put in a second system, a much smaller system. But yeah, I don't have a problem with the tankless. They are great for, particularly for houses that are only going to have one or two people in them. If you're going to be using water on a regular basis, you got a family of five, the faucet's not going to be off that often. So the tankless is not necessarily going to be all that much of an assistance.
Well, I have a power vent water system now, and that I got to tell you, I'm not happy with it. It's a 50-gallon water tank, but there's only two of us right now. And what happens is, if I turn the hot water on for a couple of minutes, all of a sudden it's kicking on that fan. And I was talked into this, and I think I should have had a regular water heater because I don't think it'd be running as often. I just kind of think it's strange. But thank you very much.
All right.
Well, I do know that the direct vent or the high-efficiency induced draft water heaters, any time that the burner fires up, the fan will have to kick on and will have to vent that out. Otherwise, you end up with the flue gases back inside. And most water heaters, if you take a shower or if you run the dishwasher, it only takes a few minutes before it will kick the burner on. So that fan only runs when the burner's on. So I would have to say that if you had a standard vent water heater, it would be fired up. You just don't notice it as often as you do when the power vent fan comes on, because it does make a little bit of noise. But the nice part about the newer units is we do have a lot more insulation on the tanks. So I've found, particularly in empty houses, a water heater with a pilot light will actually warm up more than what the temperature setting is. I try and fire a water heater anytime I do a home inspection just to hear it run, to make sure it's drafting and check the flame for proper burning. And on a vacant house, the pilot light has it hot enough that I have to turn the water on, hot water on, and let it run for 5 minutes or so to get enough cool water back in the tank to actually get it to kick back on. And that's set on its highest setting when the burner itself was actually set on a medium setting. So the insulation on the new ones are such that we don't lose a lot of heat. So they are a lot more efficient than what they used to be back before they had – I remember back in the 80s, one of the first things to do was to buy an insulating blanket and put it around your water heater.
Right.
Well, the water heater companies got smart, and they actually put that insulating blanket in underneath the housing now. So the exterior insulation blankets don't do as anywhere near as much good as they used to.
We're at our midpoint here. This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge, and the guest this morning is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance, and if you have questions, they are welcome. We have someone ready to go. Anybody else would like to call? In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Up next, someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi, Scott, I was wondering about, I have a question about the dimensions of the furnace filter. So some of these hardware stores have a special or a discount once in a while, and I'm curious how important it is to keep it, the dimensions exactly the way that the current one, furnace filter is, or is there the opportunity for a bit of leeway?
On most furnaces, I would have to say that you need to use the one that is specified. Particularly if it fits inside the furnace, there's a certain amount of space that the rack has that holds the filter, and they allow for the support of the filter by the size of the rack. And if you end up with a smaller filter, you could end up with a gap that air could go around the filter.
These would be larger.
If the furnace filter is asking for a 14 by 20 or a 16 by 20, generally the rack in the furnace is sized for that. And if you were to put in the 14 in one that requires a 16, you'd end up with a 2-inch gap that air could be pulled around the filter without going through the filter. And if you were to conversely do it the other way and try and put the 16 into the 14, you may not be able to get the cover back on the furnace, or it may hold the filter up out of position to where air can get around it. Probably the exception to that rule will be the units that slide into the return duct, because if you get one an inch or two bigger, it sticks out of the duct, but it doesn't necessarily leave any open areas where the air can get around it. But as a general rule, if the furnace is listed to have a 16 by 20 or a 14 by 20 or a 20 by 20, I've even seen some 20 by 25s, I would recommend sticking with the recommended filter size just to make sure that it's properly secured in the filter. A smaller one could tend to get pulled into the blower fan and create all sorts of problems there if the rack doesn't hold it properly, and the larger ones can possibly not seat correctly. So I would have to say to stick with the one that it's recommended for that furnace.
Thank you for your help.
All right, thanks. What you want to do is, if they go on sale, stock up on the ones that are the right size. Go out there, buy 10, and then you'll have them. You'll be all ready to go.
I'll be 100% honest. I'm guilty of this myself. I went out there. I found a sale on 16 by 20 filters, and I got them home, and mine says 14 by 20. And I can't put the cover back on it. So I have probably a good deal on some 16 by 20 filters that are sitting down in the basement.
Okay.
So I had to go back out and buy the 14 by 20s.
Well, I know in my furnace, there's a little slot that the thing rides in, and I'm not sure that it would be the wrong size either. It's just not going to fit. It never even occurred to me to, you know.
Well, there are several times where I'll find one that a 20 by 20 and somebody put a 20 by 25 in there, and I got 5 inches of filter sticking out the side of the return duct, and it's not hurting anything.
Yeah.
If you were to try and put a smaller one in there, you know, if it was required the 25 and you put the 20 in, like I say, there's 5 inches of filter space around it, or open space that's not going through it. And the importance of the filter is because – actually, your air conditioner coil sort of resembles, if you were to look at your car radiator, it's got a finned grill that it pulls the air through. And furnaces that don't have filters or furnaces that do not have filters that are properly installed get all that dust and dirt that we normally catch on the filter tend to collect on the air conditioner coil. And, of course, that coil has to be pulled out by a serviceman, and it's a lot harder to clean. So you're looking at $250 to $300 to have somebody come out and clean it if the air blocks up that coil. And if the air starts blocking up the coil, then we reduce the amount of airflow through the furnace and air conditioner, which reduces the efficiency. So the filter is a very important part of the filter system, just to make sure that the airflow does go through your fan, through your air coil, et cetera.
Yeah. Now, you go down to the hardware store or wherever, and you look at the filters, you can see that there is a pretty big spread in cost, and that has to do with how efficient their filtration is. So, the question is, well, how much do I need to spend?
And you're correct. There are several different grades. Depending on your needs, if you've got an older house that has a lot of air leakage, it probably wouldn't hurt to put a little bit better filter in it because you are getting more dust and dirt through the house. If you're the type of person that opens the windows a lot, a little bit better grade filter. If you've got a relatively new house that's relatively tight, you can probably get by with one of the lesser quality filters because we haven't got as much dirt in the house that we need to filter out. The fun part about filters is it's sort of like a good cheese. They keep getting better and better until they get so good you got to throw them away.
That's your dad's joke.
Yes, it is.
I've heard that joke before.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Basically, the filter will start filtering the air out, and as it gets dirtier, then less of the air moves through it until we don't get enough airflow through it, which means it's stopping all of the particles. Unfortunately, we're not being efficient because we're not getting enough air through the system. So that's why you need to change it on a regular basis. I've actually seen the efficiency of systems drop because somebody put in too high efficient filter, and we're not getting enough airflow through the system, so the furnace was turning on and off on the high limit switch. It wasn't moving enough air through there to cool down the heat exchanger, and it would overheat and shut itself off, let the fan run to cool it back down before turning the burner back on. And we pulled that filter out and put a different one in, and apparently the return duct sizing was probably not quite correct for the system, and the filter was just enough of an added restriction that it reduced the efficiency of the whole entire system.
Yeah, all right. We have some other callers here. We'll get back to the phones. And Bloomington, Indiana is the next in line, line number four. Hello.
Hello, Scott. This is the first time I've ever listened to this program, and I was delighted to find it. I have a question for you. We have a home that the garage was originally built as a garage, but the first owners, had a son who was a drummer, and they had it made into an insulated playroom with the ducts for heating and air conditioning. We're turning it back into a garage. What do I need to do about those vents?
Well, I'm a garage person with a couple of hot rods, so I'd leave them there so that you could have this nice warm garage to go out there and work on the cars.
Would you not worry about the fumes coming in?
Well, I would close off any return ducts and just leave supply ducts out there. There should not be a reason why you could not just block them off or close them off. No, you do not want a return air coming from a garage. If you're using it as a garage, you make sure that the return duct is well sealed or closed off so that the air from the garage does not circulate back to the house. Leaving a register or two from the house to the garage will help keep the garage warm without actually spreading the gases and the fumes from the garage back into the house. Basically, it'll pressurize it and leak out through the garage door.
How would you have this sealed off? Somebody had mentioned just putting wood, a piece of wood there, and I thought, oh, I just don't know about it. Would that seal it enough?
You do have. You're indicating that we do have a return duct in there.
I don't know, but that's what somebody had suggested. So I need to have that checked.
Yeah, if there is a return duct, chances are, since the garage was a conversion. Somebody has gone to the return system and added another section of duct to go to that room, which means you would probably get back up in your attic and disconnect that duct completely and then seal it back off in the attic. So there is no way that any of the air from the garage comes back into the house.
Okay,
your heating or cooling guy should be able to figure it out pretty quickly. Blocking off the return. Yeah, I'd probably just disconnect it wherever they teed into it. And as far as the supplies, if they've got grates on them, you could close those off. And that way, if you ever needed to heat it at some other point in time, you could.
Well, that's what I've got grates. I've got it's a big vent, you know, that goes all the way through the bottom of a house. This is a split level.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember ever seeing a return.
Yeah, if there's no return, then probably all I would do is shut them down. That should stop most of the air.
Just close them with that little vent.
It with the vent. And most of those vents are metal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that if you take some magnetic sign material like they use for making temporary signs that stick to the sides of the cars or something, you can actually cut a piece of that to fit that vent and put over the top of it, and that will close it off a little bit tighter because usually those vanes don't close them up real well. I've seen people use duct tape and everything else, which is not quite as aesthetically pleasing as something that you could put over the top of it. I do believe that in some of the handy magazines, I've seen this roll magnetic stuff that they've used for closing off ducts that are not being used. So there's a couple of different sources for it.
Okay, and then I wouldn't have to worry about it venting back into the house.
Right. Yeah, as long as there's no return air into the house, then I would not worry about the air from the from the garage getting back in the house. But you need to make sure that there is no return duct to the garage.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, very good. Well, I'll come back here. We have some local folks, and they're all in Urbana, and the first in line is number two, line number two, right here. Hello.
Hello. Yes, we have a number of basement wells, we have never put the basement well covers on them. I don't know why, but the basement wells, you know, get. We have a big overhang, but still they get leaves in them and dirt in them. And I've looked at these basement well covers, and I wondered something about the moisture condensation, because some of them are solid, you know, and they sit over there. And then there's some with holes in them, and some are thicker and some are a lot thinner. Do you have any suggestions for me?
Okay, well, I would probably not put one on that seals tightly, particularly since if you have a basement window well. Oftentimes the windows are considered an egress from the basement in case of emergency. So you don't want something that's sealed or something that would be difficult to get off. Now, if they're not something you're using for an emergency exit, you still would like to use it for some ventilation. So again, something that could either be removed or something that would have some air move through it. There's no good reason to seal a crawl space or a basement window vent or a crawl space vent well like that. I've had people say, well, water gets in there. It's like, okay, well, there should not be enough water coming in naturally, in other words, rain or water dripping off the siding, to fill a window well. The soil should absorb that. Where I run into problems is when people don't have proper grading around the outside and the soil next to the foundation settles, and so water runs back along the foundation. When that happens, then yes, you can actually fill window wells. And I've been in basements where it has a water line 8 inches high up on the window from the window wells filling up. And they're like, ooh, I need a cover. I'm like, no, you need to regrade and get the water to drain out and away. So in your case, I would say I would not get one of the really thick, expensive, sealed covers. If you want to put something to keep the leaves and stuff out, that would be fine. A simple screened cover. Again, something easily removed, so if you wanted to open the basement windows for ventilation.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good. Very good. Line number three is next in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks mm-hmm. for taking my call. Mm-hmm. How can you tell when you have to have your roof replaced, when you need a new roof? What kind of shingles would you recommend?
First of all, how you would tell.
Yeah.
It's more of an experience than anything else. The shingles are made in this area are made by what we call an asphalt shingle,
uh-huh.
usually either an organic or fiberglass mat that is saturated or permeated with asphalt. So the organic matter, the fiberglass, is then asphalt covered, and they put a mineral granule or a rock on top of it. And that rock is your sunlight or UV protection.
Uh-huh.
When the granules start to wear to where they start falling off, and you end up with holes in the granules to where you can see the fiberglass
uh-huh.
or you can see the organic mat or even the asphalt, then the sunlight usually has about 1 to 2 years before it can actually get a hole through that material.
Uh-huh.
The way the shingles are laid, they're full double coverage. The tab or the portion of the shingle that you see is only half of the shingle or part of the shingle. Most shingles are actually a three tab. So of what you see, there's actually each set of three of those is actually one shingle, and they go all the way up underneath the previous ones below it, or above it, rather.
Uh-huh.
So you end up with full double coverage. So if you get a hole in the top tab that you can see, then there is actually another layer underneath to help protect that. But you don't really want to have to rely on that. So we generally figure that if the mineral granules are off the tabs, that you're getting pretty close to time to replace it.
Uh-huh.
We can also end up with curling of the shingles, which can accelerate the wear.
Uh-huh.
If you've got a valley where two roof planes come together and a slope between them, those are usually the faster wearing areas. There's more water there. So it's usually a good indication if you look at the valleys will usually wear out about 2 to 5 years faster than the rest of the shingles. So uh-huh. if the valleys start to really look bad or start to get cracks and such, you got to stop and think that the roof is getting about time.
Uh-huh.
Most roofers will give you a pretty good, most honest roofers, which there are still several of them here in Champaign. Thought I better clarify that. they can give you an idea of how long the roof will go. Home inspectors such as myself, you can call them up and usually for $40 or $50 to run out there and spend 20 minutes climbing around on the roof, can look for roof problems and, uh-huh. and give you an idea how long a roof will last.
Okay.
But
all
it's right. more of an experience thing. It's one of those things where you can't really tell everybody over the radio exactly how,
yep.
you know, I'll walk on one and I can spend 30 seconds looking at the roof and give you a good idea, uh-huh. usually within a couple of years of how long it's going to last. But
okay.
after the first 7,000 or 8,000 roofs that I've been on, uh-huh. it's kind of a natural look for me. But unless you knew what you're looking at, you could not can't always tell.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. So if you buy a new roof and they tell you this is a 15, 20, 25-year roof, do you think, well, that's probably what you're going to get?
Yes and no, and I don't want to make any of the shingle manufacturers mad at me, but generally speaking, the warranty on a shingle is worth about as much as the paper it's written on. They're usually a prorated warranty. If you buy a 15-year roof and it only lasts 12 years, they will say, gosh, we overestimated this by 25%. So we'll give you 25% of the price of your next batch of shingles. Well, I know when I re-roofed my house, it was almost $900 for the shingles. So if they're going to mm-hmm. give me 20 or 25% of the $900, they're going to turn around and give me a check for $180 because the shingles didn't make it an extra 4 or 5 years. If the company's still around 15 years later, if you still own the house 15 years later, and if you can find the piece of paper that said which manufacturer made the shingles 15 years later.
That's a lot of if.
Correct. I would usually recommend a 20 to 25-year shingle. Anything less than that, it's not worth the labor to put them on. They don't last long enough. The longer life shingles are usually a heavier or thicker shingle. When you start getting into the thicker shingles, it's hard to put second layers on and still maintain roof integrity. So, 30 years later, the shingles start looking bad after 20 or 25 years, but they're good for 30 years where they don't leak. That doesn't mean they look good, but they're not leaking. And that's the guarantee actually says that they won't leak for that time frame. They can look like heck and start, tabs falling off, but they're not leaking. So they're still good, mm-hmm. quote unquote. I would recommend between a 20 and a 25 year shingle. I found an awful lot of 30-year shingles that go 22 years. I found a few 20-year shingles that go 25 years. But very rarely will we get an asphalt shingle roof of normal quality, or what we'll find around here, going much more than about 22 to 25 years.
Okay.
Now, there are some very heavy wind-type shingles that I find in rural properties that I've seen go 35 and 40 years. But you wouldn't want to put another layer over the top of them, and they're usually quite expensive. Probably not enough to cost justify putting the extra weight on the roof.
Okay. A couple more callers here. Next is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. About 10 years ago, I put in a new high-efficiency furnace, the kind that has a pipe that go out the side of your foundation. And in 3 years, the blower motor failed. And I think it was still under warranty, and they came out and replaced it. And then 4 years, the blower motor failed again, and this time they didn't replace it. And, of course, they go out on the coldest night of the year. And I'm wondering, it was an Amana furnace, which I thought was a good brand. And I'm wondering, is that a normal life expectancy? And should I be replacing it so I'm not waking up in the middle of the night finding the furnace has gone out? Or is that a poor part? I'm just kind of confused. I'm going to have a furnace inspection done soon, and I'm wondering what to do about it.
Okay, well, the fan you're referring to is commonly called the induction fan, and the induction fan comes on to actually draw the combustion gases through the heat exchanger to then blow them to the outside. The blower fan is usually terminology for the one that actually circulates the...
It's the blower one. It's the one that circulates up into the house.
Through the house, and it's failing that quickly?
Yeah.
I am surprised with.
Me too.
usually the ones that we have problems with, and I thought as soon as you started talking that it was going to be an induction fan issue.
No.
Because some of the early induction fans did have a fairly short lifespan, and since they're pulling some acidic gases through them, they have had some problems with them. But if the blower fan is going out that often, that is unusual. Most of the blower fans... Now, a Manna is a specialty. Most furnaces out there use relatively generic parts. Manna makes their own parts, and only their parts fit their furnaces. So you have to use a Manna dealer to do the repair works and stuff.
I had another guy.
Okay.
Who replaced the second fan. Because the person that I bought it from wasn't available.
Well, that would be number one why they wouldn't have warrantied it, because he would not have been able to get. They only a Manna authorized dealers can do warranty work. The furnace may or may not have been out of warranty. I don't know at that point in time, but only in a Manna dealer can get parts warrantied.
Okay, so my only choice then is to replace with a Manna fan. What about the servicing? I mean, is it a sealed unit, or can they get at those bearings and oil them?
Most of the new ones are a sealed bearing, usually a permeated bronze bushing, so that they don't require oiling. But no, there is no real user serviceable parts in there. I would have the serviceman check next time he's out to make sure that we don't have a blockage in like the return air where the fan is having to work extra hard. If you close off too many of the registers to where there's no air coming out, or if you've got too small a return air, the fan is trying to move air and it's creating more of a suction. It's a little harder on the motor. But that is definitely a little more what I'll call premature wear on a blower fan. Most blower fans will last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, because on the previous old clunky furnace, you know, I think once in 25 years I replaced the fan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like more of a defective part.
One of the women was actually closing off, I think, all the vents to her rooms. So that would bother it, huh?
Yeah, it could. If this fan is designed to move X amount of air, and then all of a sudden we end up reducing that in half, it actually has to pressurize, and the fan ends up having to work harder.
Okay.
Because they're usually a direct drive fan.
All righty. Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Well, we're trying to get at least one more caller. This is also someone in Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. I have gotten two roofing estimates for my house, and my house has two small flat roofs, one over the porch and one over the kitchen extension. They're not actually flat. They've got a slope. And one roofing estimate contractor wants to put on a EDPM rubber sort of one-piece roof, and the other person wants to put on a modified bitumen. It's a couple layers, and they seal it together with heat.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me pros and cons? Why I should go with one or the other? Are they both okay?
They're both very good roofing for low pitch or flat type roofs. The rubber roof actually works best for dead flat roofs. In other words, something with less than an inch in 10 feet. The modified bituminous roofing is more for something that's got a very low slope to it. The modified bituminous does not work as well with ponding. In other words, if you've got low spots where it actually holds water, whereas the rubber roofing, while it doesn't like ponding, is not as affected.
There's a pretty good slope on both of them. They have rubber roofs or whatever they used to do 20 or 30 years ago, and there's never been any problem with that. The water runs off of them.
Okay. Then either one of them would be fine. Usually your your torch-plied modified bituminous roofing will look more like a conventional roof. In other words, it usually has a mineral granule or something on it.
Yeah, whereas, he showed me samples, and it's got some.
So it looks like a roof. So it becomes more sociably acceptable in the neighborhood. Whereas the rubber roofing, like I say, they work really well on flat roofs. Almost the only thing I recommend for a flat roof, but don't always have the same aesthetic. So I think your only choice there would be which one do you like the looks of better.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, well, we'll try and go real quick here. One more, and that's Champagne and Champagne, line number three. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I have a sort of completely different question concerning crawl spaces. When we bought a house, and how to insulate them. When we bought a house, sort of there was an insulation under the floor, in the living room, and that's in the crawl space, the insulation. Now, and it's basically falling apart into pieces. Looks really ugly.
We got to be quick here. I think though we can give you the basics.
Yeah, I would recommend rather than insulating the floor, but to insulate the perimeter walls, since the crawl space is actually relatively warm. That'd be something that you could get a little bit more in depth if you wanted to call over the office sometime. I could give you a little bit more information on that.
Great.
We are running out of time here on the program. I don't want Dave to have to rush through all his info here. Yeah, insulating the floors is not where I would put the insulation for a crawl space.
It looks like one shouldn't do that because it's really falling apart, yeah.
All right, well, thank you for calling.
All right, well, I'm sorry to have to cut it kind of short there, but we here are at the end of the time. Scott will be back with us next month, so we'll do it all over again. Scott Spies works with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here on the program once a month. It's always on the third Monday?
Third Monday, 10 o'clock.
Third Monday, 10 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.